104.7 Triple M ruined it for breakfast thanks to Rossdale Homes. Now, Roo, we've been talking about concussion the last couple of weeks because of this movie that's come out from the United States.
Well, the last couple of years as well, Dits. It's been in the news, hasn't it, really?
Yeah, no doubt. Now, how many times do you reckon you were knocked out in your career?
Well, I reckon I've had concussion in the 10 to 20 sort of bracket. Knocked out probably five-ish, give or take.
Scary experience. I've never been knocked out.
Well, you don't know what's going on.
A few people have wanted to knock me out, but haven't quite.
Still might happen. it's not that scary because you don't know what's going on. The scary bit is probably afterwards when you look back and people say, oh, yeah, I was asking what your name was and you couldn't even say it, or I was asking which way you were kicking, you had no idea, or you were saying some funny things on the bench. Gee, it was funny, but it really wasn't.
Well, I heard an expert talking on radio the other day, Dr. Adrian Cohen, fascinating man. And he's heading up an organisation called HeadSafe, and I think there's a spin-off called NeckSafe as well, and he joins us now. Dr. Cohen, thanks for your time.
You're very welcome.
Listening to Roo talk here, may have been concussed 20 times. Is that scary? Has he got some bad times ahead without being too dramatic?
Oh, I think it's fair to say that, you know, you can't get away scot-free from these kinds of things. But he makes a really important point. It's not just being knocked out. So in the bad old days when, you know, the smelling salts used to come out the field, unless you got knocked out, it was considered, oh, that's just a minor knock. Don't worry about it. It was tougher nowadays. Get back up. Have a sniff of this. You'll be right. What we now know is that's a concussion. If you don't know where you are and you don't know what you're doing and you can't get to your feet unaided and you look around and you don't know which way you're running, let alone which day of the week it is, you've got a problem.
Yeah.
What is it when you've got an eye that's blurry and you can't really see out of it properly? Is that something to do with concussion or what is that, Doc?
Certainly can be. Obviously, direct trauma to the eye. And, you know, we've all seen pictures of people with bruised eyes that are closing over. That's going to affect your vision. But concussion's one of those things where it's not necessarily obvious. We don't have a big light that comes on in the centre of our forehead that goes, I'm concussed. And in fact, as doctors, we don't have a fancy device that we can scan your brain with right there and then and say, oh, the concussion meter says you're no good. We have to infer it by looking at the way your brain normally works and trying to work out whether everything is firing properly. Mm. So, you know, the brain's a complex thing. But essentially, the symptoms can be ones that you complain of, things like headache.
Yep.
That's pretty obvious. Dizziness, confusion, not knowing where you are. But when other people, like your trainer that runs out there or the medical team on the sideline look at you, they'll see the fact that you are uncoordinated, that you can't stand on your own two feet. You've got that blank robot stare, we call it. And, you know, essentially, I've seen this in players, and you feel for them because they're basically just trying to hold it together because they know if they look to one side, they're going to hit the deck. So all those sorts of things you can see from the sideline. And then you go into these fancy sideline tests that have come out through the international concussion consensus groups and say, let's get people to remember where they are. Let's ask them who they're playing. Let's go through the scores from last week. These are the sideline concussion assessment tests. And those sorts of questions came from a doctor in the AFL called David Maddox. So they're called the Maddox questions. And if you can't answer them, you're straight off. It's really simple. With most sports now, and I'm talking about AFL, rugby league and rugby union at the top level, I think we're over the hump of keeping players on the field and with all this pressure on the medical staff and coaches and everybody. We need him. Everyone realises that, firstly, it's not in the player's best interest. They mightn't be good for next week, the week after, the rest of the season if we pull him back on now. But more importantly, it's not actually good for the team. Do you want somebody out there who's not thinking straight, who doesn't remember where he's supposed to be, who hasn't got the coordination he normally has, who can't take a mark or kick without falling over? He's actually not helpful for the team, even if he's, you know, your best player normally. So you've got to rest him, you've got to give him a chance to recover, and it's like a knee injury. You know, if someone says to a player, you know what, that cruciate ligament's about to go, they can put you off on the sideline, you've got a good chance going through rehab and you'll be back in 2 weeks from now. Yep. Or we can keep you on the field and you do your cruciate and you won't play the rest of the season. What do you think the player would want? Mm-hmm. So it's obvious with ligament injuries, but it's not obvious with the brain.
Can you explain to us, if we break this right down, I know you've talked about the symptoms, what happens, dizziness and the like, and sickness and headaches, but what actually happens to the brain? Do we know that when there is a concussion?
We do, and it's really important to have an understanding. The brain's just this fleshy mass that sits inside the skull, but it sits in this fluid called CSF that kind of acts like a shock absorber, but not very well. So when you get a blow on the front of the head, the brain goes backwards. It hits the back of the inside of the skull. Then it ricochets forward, hits the front, and goes back and forwards in this this jelly-like CSF. That's not good for the underlying structure. Now, it's really important to recognize that that's not the same as having a bleed into your brain. And a lot of the stuff we do is because we're worried that if a blood vessel bursts on the surface or underneath the surface of the brain, pressure expands and the person stops breathing. And unless they have an operation, they can die. That's a bleed into the brain. Concussion is damage at a microscopic level, at the level of those important cells that exchange chemicals and electricity between them, so that process doesn't work properly. If it doesn't work at the microscopic level, it doesn't work where the cells are supposed to perform a function. Whether that function is coordinating muscle, moving things, sensing things, feeling things, your emotions, all those kinds of functions don't work properly. So even though the damage is at a microscopic level, nobody takes a scanning electron microscope along to the game because, you know, it wouldn't fit through the turnstile, you can't see what's going on. That all you can see is what's inferred by the person's behaviour. And there's no point having a CT or an MRI scanner at every venue and thinking about having the players go off the field and like on a conveyor belt at the supermarket, because there's nothing to see because it's not a bleed. It's microscopic damage.
I know you said recovery's about a week to get over it, but long term, how long can your brain recover from repeated concussions? I mean, what happens there?
That's the key question, isn't it? So we need to give people a chance to recover. And most people, you know, 90% of people will be good within 7 to 10 days. That means they've got to miss the next game and have a chance to come back. And there is a graduated return to play sequence, which says, you know, you start off by doing nothing, resting on the first day, then you can start light aerobic work, provided you have no symptoms, provided you're on no medications. And if you've had those important pre-season tests, that all of those have come back to normal.
Yep.
So we worry about the acute concussion injury and getting somebody safely back onto the field. Sometimes symptoms are prolonged, and that's the post-concussion syndrome, and then they're into a different spectrum where they're not right with their balance or their coordination or their headaches or other symptoms after a couple of weeks, and they require more intense therapy. And then you look at the long-term consequences. This disease, it's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, which is the subject of the film Concussion with Will Smith, which looked at it in NFL players. Now, there's no doubt that it's in Australian players as well. It's in Australian rugby league players, rugby union players, AFL players, anybody that's had repeated knocks. And there's two, you know, there's the spectrum of the acute concussions, the big ones, the people being either knocked out or knocked senseless on the field and seeing them and see how they recover. But there's also all those other injuries you take up over time, which add up. We need to study that and to see what's going on, but we can certainly expect that there will be long-term problems because it's just exposure. It's like exposure to coal dust in miners. It's like exposure to radiation in people who take x-rays. It's like exposure to the sun in truckies. The more you get, the more likely you are to have disease.
Are you familiar with what the NFL in America has done in recent times? I think there have been quite a lot of rule changes, and they seem to be a lot stricter. And maybe it's because they're such a litigious society. But are you familiar with the protocol over there and the rules after a player has been concussed and how it compares with what we do in this country?
I think America did take the lead a few years ago, and the other codes here are catching up. The bottom line is really simple. When in doubt, sit them out. Get them off the park and assess when it's safe for them to return. That's critical. So all these sideline assessment tests and the head injury assessments that are coming now, I follow that pattern. I think we're all very aware of it. I think that the public understand when it happens now, where in the past they might have been of a view that, oh, listen, you know, tough men stay out there and keep going through this. Tough women too. We've got to remember that concussion actually affects women more than men and girls more than boys. So just because a girl's playing netball and has an impact doesn't mean that she couldn't possibly have a concussion. Yeah. You know, it's not just those. It's any contact sport, and it's any sport in which you have contact. So we're doing our bit here, and that's the first thing. You know, we've got to recognise the injury. We've got to remove them from play. We've got to refer them. That's 3 hours so far. We know they've got to rest so they recover and then they return. So that's 5 hours.
Yep.
That's what we use for people to remember.
I heard there's links with concussions to depression and even suicide in a few stories I've read. In basic terms, how does that happen?
Well, there's no doubt that there are long-term consequences on the normal functions of the brain. So you've got to look at what that is. Some of them are motor functions. And, you know, when you see somebody with Parkinson's disease or Lou Gehrig's disease, they are changes to their motor function, so they can't move properly, movement disorders. They have problems with sensation. They have all these other neurological conditions. And if you have disturbances to your emotional well-being, those centers of the brain that govern emotion, and you know, frankly, they're just nerves. They're just other nerves. They just happen to be in a different place, and they're all affected. So if you affect those, then you can affect people's moods. They can create anxiety disorders, certainly depression, and that latest study that you alluded to, which is a Canadian study, shows there's actually a higher incidence of depression and suicide as a result of that depression in people that have had chronic exposure to concussion. The problem we have is we just don't know the numbers. We don't have the statistics. Everybody thinks, you know, we're used to seeing stuff on TV all the time, that there's this giant computer in the sky, and every time someone takes a knock, someone, you know, puts a one in the concussion column, and you add them up over the year. That doesn't happen. We don't know about most of the concussions. Less than one in 10 go to a hospital, whether they're diagnosed properly there, yeah, whether they're treated properly. We just don't have the numbers. What we do know is that people that have played contact sports at a high level end up with these problems. And one of the things that's happened in the NFL is in the settlement they've made with the players in this dispute for over $1 billion, is that the one thing that they have denied is liability. They're not prepared to say that playing sport causes this. All they're prepared to say is you played sport and you've got this.
Can I ask you about helmets? Obviously, in the NFL, helmets are all the go and have been for many, many years. We've seen here in AFL, I think also in rugby league. In fact, I reckon Jonathan Thurston wears those little, almost like a bike helmet. In both cases, headgear, more so than a helmet. So in the NFL situation and with the headgear, what do they achieve?
So there's two different types. First, we're talking about the soft headgear that's worn by rugby league and rugby union players and some AFL players. They achieve nothing.
That's a really
important message. They may stop superficial scrapes and abrasions, but as far as concussion and neck injury is concerned, they do nothing.
What would he be wearing it for then, bloke like Jonathan Thurston?
A lot of it's protection and confidence, and you know, to stop this, the idea that he may have had problems before and he feels more comfortable with it.
Gee.
When you go to the hard helmets that are used in ice hockey and American football, they are definitely meant to protect. The thing is, though, that concussion, as we talked about before, is something that affects the brain. And unless that helmet can absorb every single iota of G-force in a collision, it's actually not doing the job. And we know that they don't. Mm. Helmets clash, the brain rattles inside the skull. You've got the compounding problem then in sports, that particularly in junior sports, that people use that helmet either to lead when they're running or to lead when they're tackling or blocking, and so that people might feel more confident to do that, thinking their head's protected. And there are some padding systems in the States coming out that saying they can absorb some of that shock, but we're never going to see something that's as effective as an airbag in a car. So the airbag deploys instantly when you have a crash and protects you from moving forward. Can you imagine that in a game? In the studies that we've done with our X2 impact sensors, a little biosensor, little electronic chip that goes in the back of the player, we record, and it sits on the back of their neck, just on the bone of their skull. We record 100 or more impacts per player per game. We're never going to have 100. An airbag that goes off. 100 or more.
Wow. You wouldn't have ditched because you played out in the wing, but the blokes in the centre square got quite a few. Hey, Doc, you'd be a big fan of UFC then this Sunday, big world title match. You'd be glued to that.
I have a problem with the martial arts whose sole purpose is to cause a knockout to win. So that's boxing and UFC. And, you know, the aim of those sports is to create a brain injury.
Yep.
You've got to knock the person out, or you've got to knock them senseless so that they get TKO'd. Or UFC people would say, oh, we're different. You know, if we bloody them up and choke them so that they can't breathe, or we dislocate their shoulder, the game stops.
See, when you put it that way, it sounds barbaric, doesn't it? When you explain it that way, we are hitting each other until there's a brain injury. It does sound ancient and barbaric.
Well, you know what? You remember, you know, ice hockey in the bad old days? They used to say, you know, I went to a fight and an ice hockey game broke out.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Very
you
good.
Know, we need to mature as a civilization and say we like contact sports and we like the energy. And let's not forget that playing sport is good for us as a community. What I want to see and what we're working towards in HeadSafe is safe sport, where people understand the risks, where people understand when to sit out from the game, when to come back safely, when the codes enforce the rules so that illegal shots and high shots and head-high tackles and blows to the head are ruthlessly punished so that the clubs won't allow a player to do it and the player gets penalised so harshly for it that they've got to take it out of their repertoire.
All right, just finally, a final question from me. Again, if I can just point to the American game where I think they led the way with stopping, they changed the rules so players couldn't lead with their head when tackling and obviously spear tackles and the like. Rugby league, I think, has adopted most of those. In Australian rules, Roo, I think we saw in the last year or two, if you lead with your head, I think they've changed the rules a bit, haven't they?
Yeah, well, they ended up changing the rules and players were going in more with the head, but they've got rid of that. They've also brought in dangerous tackles. It started with sling tackles and spear tackles. Now it's anything dangerous. So this is a massive change for the game, and a lot of people still very, very confused about what it is. But my question is, though,
that Dr. Cohen, you must be pleased with that sort of progress.
I think that is progress in the right direction. And, of course, it's always going to be subjective. You know, you've got a couple of umpires out in the field. One sees it one way, one sees it another. We can use science to help us here. And I don't mean having 20 cameras on there and spending half the game looking at a replay booth. But things like these impact sensors, you know, that give us information that's objective. You've got to stop the foul play, but you've also got to recognise the inadvertent things. See, the difference between those martial arts and boxing and our sports that we enjoy is that when you go to play footy, you might get a head knock accidentally.
Yep.
That's not so deliberately. That might happen as a consequence of playing the game, playing hard. Those other sports, that's the sole purpose. So we understand the same way we understand getting in a car. You might be in an accident if you don't drive carefully. It might not even be your fault. Yeah. And we try and surround ourselves with the protections for it. You know, that's not the sole aim of it. When you go to, you know, if you're going to go to a smash-up derby, you can expect to have a head injury or two because the sole purpose of that car race is to smash into someone else.
Mm.
So if we change our rules, we change the code, that's primary prevention. We stop these things happening. We recognise when they do happen. We look after the players. The game gets better.
Mm.
It doesn't suffer. And all these people going, oh, it won't be like it used to be. You're right, it won't be like it used to be. We won't have players broken. We won't have players long-term brain injured. We won't have players, you know, who don't remember the names of their kids or the birthdays of their loved ones. We'll have players who played the game and enjoyed it and brought joy to a lot of other people in a safe environment where you know it's safe that your kids can play it.
Doc, it's been great to talk to you, and I'm interested in it, obviously, because I've had a few concussions. But one sort of question I would throw at you, there's been a lot of blokes play AFL football over a long, long period of time. How long's the game been going for, Dits?
Oh, let's say since 1870, 1880, somewhere around there.
How many blokes do you know in their 70s or 80s that are punch drunk or got serious problems? It's not a loaded question.
I don't know, but Dr. Cohen, I'd put this to you. I went to a boxing funeral a couple of years ago. A relative of mine died in his late 70s, and all of the boxers from around Australia turned up, and it was a very, very sad situation. And I mean that, you know, heroes, people that we knew who could barely speak, who were mumbling, and all of them. When you see people in one room from that one sport and how affected they were, it was actually incredibly sad. And we come from a boxing background, and yet I go back to what you said before, Dr. Cohen. I'd never thought about it that way, but you it's a sport where you're punching each other until you have a brain
injury.
But
in footy, is it I know a lot of old blokes, and I don't know any of them that are like that, Dits.
Mm.
Well, that's what we've got to learn. We've got to study this. And there was a very interesting study done by a colleague of mine in Melbourne, Alan Pearce, where he went back and looked at past players. The same things happened in rugby union and rugby league with the major study. And there's no doubt, like that American study, that there's higher incidence of musculoskeletal disease, of neurological disease, and of emotional disease in players that have played the game. Now, the defendants will go, oh, you know, there's a lot of other things. These people might have used drugs. These people might have had, you know, abused alcohol. These people might have been risk-taking aggressive people to start with, which might have put them into the game. And that's true. But until we can study and isolate the effect of actually playing and of the repeated head knocks, we can't actually understand what component came from the game itself. We use the mantra that if you can measure it, you can manage it. And we've got to start measuring it and understanding what's going on. And, you know, it's not pulling the sport apart just for the sake of it. It's actually understanding what's going on because we want to understand how it affects each and every individual. And there's a huge variety. You know, we all know people that have taken huge knocks and have been 100% normal. And so we tested them. We could test them up the wazoo. They'd be 100%. We've also had players. We've had players walk off the field and we've measured 180 Gs. So we know that Muhammad Ali boxed at 60 Gs. We know that racing car drivers go around the curve at 10 G. We've measured 180 and the player is completely normal. Ooh. We've also had a player knocked out at 40.
Yep.
So something about that player, that day, that condition, the force and the rotational component of that force, maybe whether he had his banana for breakfast, will have affected that individual. And until we get it down on that level, we can't manage the risk for individual. We can just say for the code as a whole, let's make sure that if we see a concussion, you have the right amount of time out. We check that you're right to go back and you come back to the game safe.
Dr. Adrian Cohen, this is a fascinating topic. It really is. Good luck with your ongoing work with HeadSafe and with NeckSafe. If people want any information, I know you've got websites as well if they want to find out more. But this has been a really, really interesting chat. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Dr. Adrian Cohen.